Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory. Welcome to Backstory, the show that explains the history behind today's headlines. I'm Joanne Freeman.
I'm Nathan Connolly.
And I'm Brian Ballow.
If you're new to the podcast, we're all historians, and each week, along with our colleague Ed Ayers, we explore a different topic in American history.
Today, we're talking about a difficult issue. So, just a disclaimer here. Some things in this episode might be troubling for some people to hear.
If you think white supremacy is only the Ku Klux Klan burning a cross, or white men in khaki pants and white polo shirts marching before Charlottesville, then you're getting it wrong.
This is Glenna Gordon. She's an award-winning documentary photographer, and she spent a lot of time covering women in the far right and white supremacist movement.
Some of my portraits are, some people find some of them difficult. Some people find some of them upsetting because not everybody looks like a meth head from Tennessee joining the Klan, which is what I think a lot of people think people on the far right look like. And people can sometimes be really surprised when they see my portraits and they just look like another pretty girl from another town. Others of my portraits, I hope, are a little bit layered and will show people in a way where I want the image to do the talking. So
Glenna says the far right and white supremacist movement can't function without women. Case in point, a woman Glenna met in Charlottesville, Virginia, after the deadly Unite the Right rally in August 2017. It all started with an invitation to a party from white supremacist leader Richard Spencer.
It was like a VRBO or some other sort of vacation rental house that was being rented by Identity Europa, which was Spencer's group, was one of the more active groups responsible for Charlottesville. And this is 7 hours after Heather Heyer has been killed and after the day's events. And there's probably about 100 to 150 people at this party that I show up at. And it's mainly men. It's about, I'd say it's like a 10-to-1 ratio of men to women. But I'm there to meet some of the women who are in leadership in Identity Europa. A really good example of this is a woman like Erica. And Erica, who asked me not to use her last name, and those were the terms of the interview, so I will not use her last name. She has been active in IE it used to be IE, now it's the American Identity Movement, for years, and she's a known organizer. And so when you think about what happened the day of Charlottesville, you think about Heather Heyer dying, but there's a lot of other people who are responsible for that day. And so someone like Erica, in the lead up to Charlottesville, she's posting on Discord, which is an app that people are using to communicate and plan. And she's helping people organize riots. She's hosting the party. She's walking around the party to make sure that nobody's trashing this rental house. Women do women's work in these groups. They are not necessarily leadership front and center because that's the role of men, but they are making sure everything happens. Another example of that is like this woman, Amanda Barker, who I met in North Carolina, who's the wife of a Klan leader. And so she's called Imperial Commander Amanda. And even though her husband, Chris, is the one putting up the cross and setting it on fire, she's the one organizing the carpools for everybody to get there, organizing the potluck beforehand. And why are people going? They're going to burn a cross, but they're also going to have a potluck and to hang out with the people who they believe share their identities and have their backs. And so somebody like Amanda is making sure that that happens. She's also the one addressing all of the mail that goes out when people call and leave their address on her hotline. Like, she's doing labor to support this group, even though people think of Chris as the leader alone. He could not run one of the most active chapters of the Ku Klux Klan in America. He needs her to actually do most of the quote-unquote women's work, the support work that is actually what is the daily grind of these groups.
Sometimes Glenna receives pushback about the nature of her work, that taking photographs of white supremacists amplifies their message. Glenna says she takes this concern seriously, but that we ignore white supremacy at our peril.
All of these groups already are out there. I think that part of why we got to where we are is because so many people are like, just ignore them and they'll go away. Don't give them air. If you give them air, then they just spread their messages. And I disagree with that, right? They've spread their messages while we were ignoring them, while all these coastal elites are busy, you know, celebrating the progress of our first Black president. You know, these groups were thriving. And that was because we ignored them.
Glenna says one way we've ignored white supremacists is by not seeing them, which is why photography is so important.
I think the best photos, when I'm trying to take a good photo, I'm trying to take a photo that has a complicated set of layered meanings and that somebody will look at and sort of stop and say, oh. And you know, like the photo of Erica, she's beautiful, but it's also kind of a creepy photo. I certainly hope it's creepy. I think it's a little creepy. There's very, very dramatic lighting and like you see her tattoo on her chest that says, I will never be silenced. And I think we have to look at these things, and I think that they have an ability to punch us in the gut in a way that's really different than like another 1,200 word opinion piece in the New York Times that, you know, gets some clicks, not too many. If we need to change the way America talks about race and thinks about white supremacy, we have to look at women and we have to look at how these ideas are spread. And if you only look at acts of violence, if you only look at acts of vandalism, then you're only looking at the tip of the iceberg. And you will always only be responding afterwards when there is an act of violence or where there is an act of vandalism or there is like a rally or anything like that. You're responding after. If you are looking at the entire iceberg, if you are looking at how white supremacy operates as a system, you have to look at who are the people keeping it afloat. And because women always do as much, if not more work than men in most arenas, most of the time, that is also true for white supremacy. Women are what keep these groups alive.
Often seen as a movement circulating at the fringes of American society, white supremacy has been in the news recently.
Last month, a House Oversight Joint Subcommittee held hearings on white supremacy, and the Department of Homeland Security announced it will now recognize white nationalism as a major threat to the United States.
But the discussion of white supremacy in America rarely includes women. Despite that fact, they play an important, if overlooked, role in the movement.
So today on Backstory, we're digging into the little-known history behind the topic of women in white supremacy. You'll find out why the issue has been overlooked by historians.
And you'll learn about how white women used public education to further white supremacy from the Jim Crow era and beyond.
When you open up a history book to read about the period before the Civil War, there's a good chance you'll find slavery depicted as an institution powered by white men. This is a story Stephanie Jones Rogers wants to change. She says historians have overlooked the role white female slave owners played in propping up slavery and promoting white supremacist values. The problem was coverture, the legal system that stripped women's right to hold property. Many people have assumed coverture was absolute. In other words, they believe a white woman might inherit enslaved people from her father, but when she was married, her property became her husband's. Turns out, though, coverture wasn't absolute, and many white women found ways to circumvent the laws. To learn more, I caught up with Stephanie Jones Rogers. She's the author of They Were Her Property, White Women as Slave Owners in the American South. I started by asking her how she came to the topic by using a well-known but underutilized source, narratives taken by formerly enslaved people in the 1930s, also known as the WPA narratives.
You know, when I started this project about 10 years ago as a graduate student, I was reading the scholarship produced around the African-American experience, particularly in slavery, and also examining the scholarship around white women's experiences in the South. And noticed that there was a disconnect around the question of whether white women were deeply and profoundly invested in the economy of American slavery, whether they bought and sold slaves and hired them, etc. I think the disconnect really revolved around the different types of sources that were being used. In the scholarship around the African-American experience, many scholars were, in fact, looking at those interviews with formerly enslaved people, mm-hmm. but they weren't looking at them to answer the question, what did formerly enslaved people have to say about white women's economic investments in their continued enslavement and captivity? Mm-hmm. And so by looking at those interviews and asking that different question of those sources, I was able to find out that formerly enslaved people talked about this all the time, and they answered this question in a variety of ways all the time.
And that focus on economics, I mean, it really does allow you to explode a lot of kind of two-dimensional renderings of the plantation myth and who is the wicked slave master versus the kind of, you know, sympathetic mistress and, you know, these beleaguered African-Americans who are just kind of, you know, milling around on the plantation looking for a kind eye from the mistress to alleviate these conditions. I mean, you're describing, you know, white women slave masters who are, in some cases, even more brutal than their white male counterparts. And again, driven by this economic imperative. What's going on there?
So one of the things that became really clear to me as I looked at what formerly enslaved people had to say about white women's economic investments in the institution is that these investments began when these women were actually young girls, sometimes even infants. So what they show, what they talk about is the fact that young girls were inheriting enslaved people as gifts. So they were given enslaved people as gifts when they were just infants, as Christmas gifts, as wedding presents, as birthday gifts. So they were showing how over the course of these young women's lives, these white women's lives, they were receiving enslaved people as property. If you start the story there, if you start the story in girlhood and in infancy, you realize that white women had every reason to hold tight to and to invest in the institution. And what that meant is that they were willing to enact violence and to perpetrate acts of violence and brutality to keep them submissive and to bend to their will.
To the extent that you feel comfortable with the details, can you give us an example of the kinds of violence that you would see meted out at white women's hands?
So one particularly powerful example that I talk about in the book is a young girl, enslaved girl, who had a mistress who essentially kept the enslaved people that worked in the household and that she owned in near starvation. And so this woman, this white woman, decided one day to leave a piece of candy on a piece of furniture. And this young enslaved girl was tasked with cleaning that particular room. Mm-hmm. So one day she gave into her temptation. She ate the piece of candy and her mistress decided to punish her for that. She put the young girl, the young enslaved girl's head under the rocker of her rocking chair. And then she called upon her white daughter to inflict a whipping on the young enslaved girl. So as her daughter was whipping the young enslaved girl, she was rocking back and forth on the enslaved girl's head. And she caused such physical damage that this young girl was never able to eat solid foods again until her elder years. She was deformed and disfigured in her face. So this is the kind of brutal violence that was enacted in these households, not by white men, but by white women as well as young white girls.
I'm thinking about a book, Good Wives, Nasty Wenches, and Anxious Patriarchs. And there, you know, Kathleen Brown describes a kind of anxiety of control that white men had over the entire plantation household. It was control over their wives, but also control over the slaves themselves, enslaved people. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious about this question of anxiety. Like, what are the kinds of concerns, in addition to the economic concerns, that might be driving the kinds of brutality that you're describing in this work?
Well, I think in large part, white women had the same kind of anxieties around the control that they hoped that they had. These are women who are charging enslaved people with the most intimate forms of labor that we could possibly imagine. They charged enslaved mothers with wet nursing, breastfeeding their infants, their newborns and their infants. And when you think about the kind of intimacy, the level of intimacy mm-hmm. that's involved in that kind of labor, the fact that they are really putting the lives of their infants in the hands of women who they may come to own eventually, you also realize that these enslaved people had the power of life and death over the future of the white race in some cases. So I think what you see is that some of these white women are, in fact, kind of grappling with the kind of contradictions, the paradoxes that were kind of embedded in the institution of slavery, wherein you assume that these people are willingly doing this work, mm-hmm. but you also they also know deep down that these individuals are only able to perform in this way or performing in this way because of the persistent threat of violence.
Wow.
And so I think these white women are also, you know, cognizant of the fact that at any moment, these individuals could, in fact, take the lives of their children as well as their own lives, cooking their food, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And intimacy and anxiety, I imagine, is deeply connected with the idea of marriage, too. Many of these white women who, because of American laws of coverture, are, you know, coupling, but then concerned about their property basically being taken over by white male husbands. So again, there's a loss of a certain amount of autonomy that comes through an intimate relationship. I'm very curious about how marriage, again, impacted the way that many of these white women owned slaves, treated slaves, you know, dealt with the passage of slaves from one generation to the next. I mean, what was there a sense that white women's status as owners would be compromised through the marriage contract?
If you give a white woman or a white girl an enslaved person mm-hmm. as a child, mm-hmm. and they grow up with this child, they grow up with this person not simply as a playmate, thinking of them as a playmate, but also understanding that they are property too. Once they become marriageable age, they're not willing to relinquish the profound and deep investments that they have in the ownership of that person. Before they even get married, they are thinking of ways to circumvent the laws of coverture. Mm. They are thinking of how to protect the property that they bring into marriage. And they do that by figuring out the loopholes, figuring out the ways in which the law allows them to do that. And one of the ways that the law allows them to do that is through what are called marriage contracts or marital contracts, or what we would today call prenuptial
right.
agreements.
That's what it sounded like, yeah.
So they enter into these prenuptial agreements where they sketch out what property they're bringing into the marriage, what levels of control they hope to continue to
wow.
have over that property,
wow.
What control they will have over any property they may inherit in the future, that they may purchase in the future, all of the legal, the kind of legal constraints that they would confront through coverture, they're able to kind of sketch out these loopholes, mm-hmm. the workarounds.
Mm-hmm.
So they work around the laws of coverture by protecting their slaves, by putting them in separate estates as well. So what we would consider to be a trust fund today,
mm-hmm.
they work with parents in some cases to devise or to construct trust funds. And so through those two really important legal instruments, they're able to do what formerly enslaved people said they did, which is to control in almost absolute fashion the enslaved people that they bring into their marriages, that they purchase after marriage, and that they may inherit during their marriages as well.
Again, this just flies in the face of so many dominant narratives coming out of this period. I mean, many white women themselves who are of a particular class and, again, who are literate, they're trying to fashion themselves in 19th century writings as being the quote-unquote delicate sex, or that they're somehow more virtuous or benevolent. I mean, how do you think any of this, you know, is served to conceal the brutality that is happening under white women's ownership in the 19th century South?
So I am certainly not a literary scholar, but I do read what literary scholars have to say about the act of writing a diary, what's kind of going on mm-hmm. behind the scenes when diarists choose to write the things they do. And these are calculated writings.
Mm.
These are writings that the diarists are writing with an audience in mind sometimes.
Right.
And so what I talk about at the end of the book is the ways in which after slavery's over, former slave-owning women and the descendants of former slave-owning women, you know, take up the pen to, in fact, do exactly what you say, to craft a narrative of slavery in which white women play simply benevolent roles, that they are divine creatures who are essentially, they're born to slavery, so they are not actively engaged the perpetuation of the institution. They are born to it, so they have no choice but to live in a culture and environment in which slavery is fundamental. But they also whitewash and sanitize the roles that they play in the economy of American slavery and the brutality of slavery and the terror of slavery.
I'm just curious about how you would describe the impact or the legacy of white women's storytelling around slavery and allowing white supremacy to remain a constant feature of what Southern and really American life has to abide by in the late 19th and early 20th century.
Karen Cox's work on the wonderful work on the United Daughters of the Confederacy shows that the construction of these narratives, of these very sanitized narratives, they're all kind of connected. That we think of, you know, history as something that's written by male victors, but in this case, it's, you know, history is written by female victors as well. And what I mean by victors is that while white Southerners who were loyal to the Confederacy that embraced secession may have, in fact, lost the war, but they certainly did not lose the ideological war. They certainly, very important dimensions of the story of slavery have in large part been crafted at the end of their pens. When you erase many of the important roles that white women played in the economic dimensions of the institution, in the construction of a racially divided social order, the afterlife is that anytime we see white women participating in kind of these horrid acts of racial terror, racial violence, we scratch our heads and we're shocked, you know?
Right.
And I think it's in large part because of that very conscious act of narration, the very conscious act of constructing a very sanitized narrative of slavery in which white women don't play brutal, violent parts.
Now, I mean, this is, you know, a way I have to imagine of not just concealing the ideological commitment that white women might have to mm-hmm. white supremacy, but also about this property question, just going right back, right, and saying that there's a form of wealth that's created in human flesh that white women simply don't want to be associated with. So how much of it do you think, I mean, and not to quantify it, but to what degree would you suspect that a lot of this myth-making is about concealing the ways in which white women are generating wealth out of slavery?
Well, I should also say that one of the things that other historians have shown for the colonial period, which I'm finding to be true in the 19th century, is that white slave-owning parents typically gave their daughters more slaves than they did land. And they did so with this idea that when a young couple married, that the daughter would bring the slaves and the son would bring the land and they would have everything they needed to start. So this was considered kind of a nest egg situation or you know, like this is to get them started on these new lives that they were beginning. And when you think about the fact that white women are receiving upon marriage far more slaves than they are any other form of property. Mm-hmm. What that also suggests is that they have a deeper investment in the institution of slavery, and that investment is profoundly economic in large part because most, if not all, of their wealth is bound up in the bodies of enslaved people. We really do have a concept of wealth as heavily gendered, a gendered concept of wealth in which men possess wealth, women benefit from men's wealth. And here what I show and then what I'm going to show in the second project is that women are bringing a substantial amount of wealth into their marriages, so much so that some men, some husbands have nothing. And women are the ones who come in with the wealth. Women are the ones that are financing their husband's speculative pursuits in cotton, for example, or in businesses or in the railroad.
So as a final point, I'm curious about what your research taught you about feminism in the late 19th century, if we feel comfortable even describing what's happening in the plantation context as being part of this genealogy around feminism, because you have obviously Black women who are recounting their experiences being enslaved. You have white women who are imagining a vision of gender equality that is hinged to the property relationship. And after all of this gets undone by emancipation, there's a need to still fight for women's rights, however folks chose to define that. And so I'm just curious about this kind of world torn apart, that is there anything that you see as new in our learning about feminism and how feminism gets fashioned out of the slave moment?
Another reason why the story that I tell in this book, you know, hasn't really factored into what we know about slavery and particularly white Southern women's investments in it is in large part because of the fact that the field of women's history emerges during the same moment that the feminist movement of the 20th century is taking shape, is becoming a powerful force in our country. And so ultimately, the narratives that emerge out of that moment are triumphant narratives, are narratives of women being empowered in ways that empower those around them, you know, that forge alliances and create alliances.
Exactly.
And this is a feminist story, but it's not that feminist story. This is a very ugly, what I call a very ugly feminist story. And what it shows is that for these women, slavery was their freedom.
Right.
Their
exactly.
freedom as women was really contingent upon their decision to embrace whiteness and white supremacy in a time when they were experiencing gender oppression. And so I think it serves as a lesson for us in the present as we look at certain, for example, voting patterns amongst some white women in the country, and we scratch our heads. What it shows is that there are moments in which white women have chosen to embrace white privilege and white supremacy in spite of fighting against, struggling with gender oppression. Whiteness offers them privileges and benefits that their gender certainly does not.
Stephanie Jones Rogers is an associate professor of history at UC Berkeley. She's also the author of They Were Her Property, White Women as Slave Owners in the American South.
We all deserve to be able to further our knowledge, to keep learning. And that's what the Great Courses Plus is all about. They make it possible to learn from some of the brightest minds out there that many of us would not otherwise have access to. Professors from some of the best universities in the world, experts from National Geographic and the Smithsonian. And with the Great Courses Plus app, you can watch or listen anytime, anywhere. You might try checking out their new course, Play Ball, The Rise of Baseball as America's Pastime, created in partnership with the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum, or you might check out A New History of the American South with our own Ed Ayers, another one of the great courses offered by The Great Courses. We know you're going to love The Great Courses Plus, and right now they're offering our listeners this amazing deal. Unlimited access to all of their courses free for a month. So start your free month today and sign up now through our special URL. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/backstory. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/backstory. Today we can get a glimpse into the current world of white supremacy through the lens of Glenna Gordon's striking photography. And as we just heard, white women helped maintain slavery as an institution. But what about the role of white women in between those two eras? As the United States moved from Jim Crow to the Civil Rights Movement, what were white women doing, and how did they respond to changes in society?
They're sort of like the church ladies of white supremacist politics, you know, the people that are doing all the groundwork, maybe not the sort of public speaking or being lifted up as the spokesman, but doing the work that makes that possible.
Historian Elizabeth Gillespie McRae has researched how white women were behind a lot of the pushback against racial equality from the 1920s to the 1970s. She says when we think about people promoting white supremacy, we often focus on the role of men in political power. But while men may have written the rules for upholding racial segregation, white women molded those rules into a reality.
I didn't start out really looking for white women. I started out looking for how racial segregation was upheld and reproduced and shaped and reshaped in the American South. And what I found everywhere I looked was women working on this grassroots level, you know, being the sort of grassroots workers for social welfare policy. And as teachers reporting to their superintendents or principals that they thought there was a Black child who was passing in their classrooms, or working to shape the history that was told in public school textbooks.
A lot of women's work defending segregation orbited around the Brown v. Board of Education ruling in 1954. But McRae says pushback against school integration is only one piece of white supremacy's puzzle during this time period. Another big piece can be found when women achieved the right to vote in 1920.
When women were talking and pushing for the right to vote in the South, some suffragists kept assuring the broader public, and particularly the male elected officials, that their votes would uphold racial segregation, not destabilize it. Mm-hmm. It could be strategy, right? Like, at first I was like, oh, wow, is this just a strategy and they're going to give up on this once they get the right to vote? And I think it's probably both, right? For some, it was a strategy that the outcome was worth sacrificing principled political rhetoric on the front end. But with that sort of promise that they would uphold racial segregation, I began to look at how they did it. And I think we imagine, right, that the quest for more rights and the people pushing for sort of equal voting rights imagine a landscape of equal voting rights for all, but many did not.
Now, one of the ways in which these grassroots white women were enforcing white supremacy is through policing social welfare institutions. And you talk about the Racial Integrity Act, which was implemented in Virginia in the 1920s. So tell us a little bit more about the Racial Integrity Act and how that is an example of these white women bolstering white supremacy.
So the legislation, which is passed in 1924, comes out of both a national and kind of a pretty state-level effort. The folks pushing the Racial Integrity Act believe in eugenics. They believe in this sort of false race science. And they're also fearful that more and more, with the hardening of racial segregation, that more and more people are passing from Black to white or from Indian to white. They're particularly interested in shoring up and hardening the line between Black and white. So in Virginia, in order for it to work, people on the ground have to kind of report on their neighbors and friends and school children and alert people to passing. And so the work, in order to enforce the Racial Integrity Act, it falls on midwives who deliver most of the babies at this time, on school teachers, on registrars who were doing marriage and birth certificates. And so it is really women that become the vanguard of the Racial Integrity Act. It's nurses writing to the state saying, oh, I think we admitted this person to the hospital that is Black but not white. And the law would have sat there without these sort of local enforcers. And these local enforcers were women, and they were women really familiar with the communities. I mean, they had sort of local authority as teachers and as social welfare workers.
Wow. So these white women doing really the legwork and being the eyes and the ears. I mean, it's a reminder, right, that passing a law is one thing, implementation is another. And your work's pointing out how these white women are really at the root of that.
Right. And they weren't screaming like racist epithets, right? Like, their work was quiet and sort of sustained, and they were, in their mind, they were following the law. I don't know whether they were committed to white supremacy or not, but it doesn't matter because their work shored up the system for a long time. Even in the 1980s, people were having babies in hospitals in Lynchburg, and the hospital officials would look at their last name and declare their racial identity, even if the mother disputed it.
Now, another way that these white Southern women are really enforcing white supremacy is through education. So how were these women using public education as a kind of platform for white supremacy?
It's a place that women, even before the vote, had carried some sort of public authority, right? Schools were thought to be kind of an extension of the home, and maybe not in policy, but in practice, public education was dominated at the sort of ground level by women. In the interwar period, so between 1920 and World War II, white women had really won the battle in terms of what was in the nation's textbooks. I mean, it was a very white South-friendly narrative, a narrative of sort of reconciliation around imperialism, or a narrative that said Reconstruction was corrupt, and it was corrupted by African-Americans and greedy Yankees who came down to the South. And I mean, that was the story told. So the national narrative was kind of dominated by this white Confederate narrative. But these sort of female producers of white supremacist thought kept telling white women that they had to work to make sure that their schools kept up those stories. And it was particularly important as former Confederates and people who had memories of the Civil War and Reconstruction and the birth of Jim Crow died out, that women needed to be really vigilant about what was being taught in their schools.
So tell us about an essay contest that students were encouraged to write.
Well, in the interwar period, they were often about sort of celebrating the Confederacy. So why was the Confederacy right to secede? But after World War II, as the Allies in sort of shoring up racial segregation begin to defect, the Democratic Party and the Supreme Court and the United Nations is offering a kind of multicultural education curriculum, segregationist women begin to sort of retool these essay contests. So the White Citizens Councils, for example, in Mississippi, will have essay contests even as late as 1959 and 1960 about why segregation is best for both races. And the prize for one girl and one boy from Mississippi is $500, which at that point would have paid for 4 years of a college education at the University of Mississippi. So we're not talking about, you know, chump change for this, right? For an essay, it's not like $25. It's $500. And thousands of students wrote these essays. So there's 16 in 1959. They're still around. Like, that was their sort of education. But that's a way that even after the Brown decision, that folks continued to cultivate a curriculum in kind of a segregationist education, so that when the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act passed, you had a new group, a young group of white Southerners and white Americans who had been trained and taught this narrative that was really counter to the civil rights movement.
Now, it strikes me some of what you're talking about in all of these different ways in which these white Southern women are having power to influence things is partly the morality of motherhood power. Is that part of what they're banking on here?
It is part. And I think the female political strategists of segregation try all sorts of different languages. They employ motherhood, like if you're going to be a good mother, you need to uphold racial segregation. They experiment with like languages of sort of citizenship. They'll try out colorblind rhetoric. But motherhood is really central in the way, if we follow sort of how they craft ideas of motherhood, it bleeds over later into a language of family values, that they can sort of draw the line between what it means to be a good white mother. And so being a good white mother meant, in many ways, that you taught the lessons of racial segregation and that the larger society could recognize what a good mother you were by the racial distance that your children kept. But the language of motherhood meant that you could cross class lines, right? If racial distance was the mark of being a good white mother, then poor white women in the architecture of segregation could uphold that, right? So the women in New Orleans, like in the Ninth Ward in New Orleans, which was a working class white neighborhood in the 1950s and 60s, they could be good white mothers because they could ensure that their kids went to segregated schools, right? In a way that economically, in an integrated world, they would not be able to move to the suburbs and make sure that their kids went to virtually all white schools. But in a system of legalized segregation, they could be good white mothers.
Now, I'm going to make a comparison that's going to sound wacky, but in the late 18th century, when people were talking about the French Revolution, some people were very worried about women because they said that women could sneak into places and crawl between the lines and do things that men couldn't do precisely because they weren't sort of full-fledged citizens. And it sounds kind of like that's part of what you're describing here, is that it's their somewhat compromised status that actually gives them a kind of power.
Yes. White women have this precarious position in a sort of system of white supremacy because their bodies are particularly important. By crossing the racial line in terms of marriage and sex, they can destroy the color line. And so it's really important that white women are policed too. And a lot of the work the most active female segregationists do is about policing white women too, to making sure that they don't do that. But I think you're right in the way that the queer women that I write about believe that they're more powerful because they're not seeking the rewards of the party. So they can be ideologically pure because they're not going to lose a committee assignment. They early on begin to talk about how Democratic men, big D, Democratic men in the South, are going to follow the party because they can't adhere to their principles in the way white women can. And so it is up to white women. If they break from Roosevelt's politics, they're not going to be punished. I mean, because they don't have these sort of committee assignments or positions in the party. And so it is their compromise position that allows them to think that they are the sort of the true believers and the gatekeepers for racial segregation.
I'm curious to hear how you think that, I guess the politics, but more important than that, the rhetoric of these white women segregationalists has evolved into the early 21st century. So are there places where you really see echoes of this kind of activism in today's culture?
So we're going to back up just a second. If you were a real committed segregationist and advocate for white supremacist politics as a woman, you find yourself moving right out of the Democratic Party into the Republican Party and then into the far right, like the most committed. That's sort of their trajectory. And in the late 1960s and early 1970s, President Nixon pushes Congress to reconsider the Genocide Convention, which was a UN convention that came out of World War II, right, condemning genocide. And the U.S. had never ratified that. And in part, they hadn't ratified it because of the work of white women. And in the late 1960s and 70s, see women and men of the far right writing their senators saying, do not ratify the Genocide Convention. And their reason is they believe it would limit the power of the police and that the police would be prosecuted for genocide for their treatment of the Black Panther Party. In some ways, I see this sort of segregationist rhetoric and the sort of far right version of that as sort of feeding the conversation we have today about police brutality and Black Lives Matter. And so I think the other sort of continuation is that after the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, and I think the way the public discussion is about white supremacist politics today, I think we're continuing to ignore the work what women do on the grassroots level.
Elizabeth Gillespie McRae is an associate professor of history at Western Carolina University. She's also the author of the book, Mothers of Massive Resistance, White Women and the Politics of White Supremacy.
Hey, Nathan, Joanne. Those are some terrific interviews. And I came away with one question, which is, if women are such a crucial part of the story, How come in the history of things, we're only beginning to just talk about them now?
Well, I think part of the answer to that question is tied up with what I felt was a big irony about all of the content of these interviews, which is that for so long, historians, and I think just generally people, have dismissed women's work as being unimportant or secondary or, you know, sort of just working in the background to keep things going. And part of that has been dismissing all of the work and all of the effort and all of the impact that all of the interviews in this show are really showing today.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I would agree. If you think about the cycle of how groups get incorporated into national conversations about history, I think it was really necessary and important in the late 60s and early 70s to think about how, you know, feminism and women's presence in the history really gets integrated into the big stories that we tell. And you have to obviously think about suffrage and you think about the women's rights movement. But then to, you know, Joanne's point, you know, if you take the capacious definition of work, that also means, you know, working sometimes at history's underside. I think there's a very important progression that we're seeing where the full completeness of women's roles on a variety of different good versus evil axes, I think, is now finally getting rounded out all the way.
So do we run a risk here of forgetting that even these female plantation owners, even women creating myths about Confederate society and how wonderful slavery was, that they too were oppressed at the very time that they were oppressing?
I mean, I think we can, you know, very safely talk about how women's activities were circumscribed by patriarchy, even as they're engaging in white supremacist work. You look at the, you know, United Daughters of the Confederacy, for example, and, you know, they are engaged in, you know, basically helping to advance a very particular vision of the lost cause and of the happy plantation, but relegated to the domestic sphere. I mean, you know, you're talking about an organization that had, you know, some 45,000 members shortly after the turn of the century. And what they're basically, you know, doing with that woman power in large measure is, you know, engaging in, you know, very clear moments of memory or refashioning the plantation memory, building a MAMI, or proposing to anyway, MAMI monument on the Washington Mall. That was one of their big projects. And that is still, you know, a very small way of contributing to what was the larger workings of Southern society at that time. In other words, they were circumscribed to the parlors and in ways that, you know, were going to make sure that white men were still the dominant representatives of the political power of the former Confederacy.
I'm going to pivot to the post-World War II period, because growing up in Coral Gables, Florida in the 1960s, I was taught in my civics class about the War of Northern Aggression.
Seriously? And
seriously.
Really?
Yep.
In Miami. Wow.
In Miami.
Wow.
And I was taught that by, won't mention his name, but a male teacher. What I never realized until I listened to earlier parts of the show was that it was probably women who inserted that in our textbooks. Mm. I never really thought about how crucial women were to maintaining that lost cause, War of Northern Aggression, whole take on the Civil War. And, you know, that strikes me as pretty important.
And that's, you know, political power is one kind of power. Cultural power is another kind of power. And it's a power that can be wielded, I think, more easily and seemingly more safely by people who lack a certain degree of political power.
Exactly. Those nurses, those recording clerks, those social workers who were literally implementing the white supremacist thoughts reflected in legislation. That, you know, to me, as somebody who studies bureaucracy, that's a pretty potent form of power and a pretty enduring one.
I mean, one of the things that I like about exploring this question about, you know, white women inside the workings of white supremacy is very similar to what I find to be fruitful about talking through exploitation being done by African-American business people or, you know, landlords in particular, and some of the stuff I've written about in the past, which is to say that the mere presence of a black business person does not remove the possibility that a tenant can be exploited or an employee can be taken advantage of, right? And the mere presence of a woman worker within an organization or even an organization run by women, the mere fact of that woman's presence or labor does not necessarily mean that it's a place of progressive politics. And I think we fall oftentimes into the trap of simply thinking that the presence of women or people of color within an organization or within an institution therefore means that that institution will behave in the interest of those people. So to me, feel very heartened that it raises at least for us a way of asking questions slightly differently, which is to say, you know, what's the aim of the organizations and how can we look at the subjects or the targets of those different collective bodies as being the more important place to examine whether or not that is a useful political movement or institution or what have you.
I don't know what to do with this, but I'm going to say it anyway and just sort of see where it goes. Listening to the interviews and thinking about the topic of this show, speaking as a white woman, some part of me feels guilt. And I suppose you could say some of that's attached to privilege, but it isn't just attached to privilege. It's looking at these people and knowing that I am one of these people and feeling some degree of shame and not quite, you know, and not quite knowing what to do with that feeling and not quite feeling that it's entirely logical, but it's a very strong feeling.
Right. I would say that you are not one of these people, and I would say
thank you,
and
Nathan.
I would say it in the same way that, you know, I would not feel comfortable, you know, if somebody drew a parallel between me and, you know, a Booker T. Washington kind of figure, right? Which is to say that the context that we're living in is different, that the way that we are concerned about these questions are, you know, decidedly different than our historical predecessors. And that there might, in fact, be different ways that we can identify with past historical subjects than our racial identity. You know, for the same reason that, you know, you can kind of dress up as who you want to on Halloween, I mean, we can really claim that our historical forebears are broader than merely the people who we might, you know, check one box, you know, alongside. I think there are a lot of different ways in which our political affinities and, you know, subject positions can be. I don't think the mere fact of race should be that which limits us to how we think about our legacy, traditions, and heritage.
I think that's true. And I also think now that we're talking about this and I've put this out into the air, I think part of what I'm feeling is precisely where we began our discussion, which is something is being exposed and revealed as being powerful and not admirable. And it's something that everyone, including me, has not necessarily reckoned with before. And so as a white woman, I suppose some of what I'm feeling is just recognition of a past that maybe I hadn't fully recognized before. That's going to do it for us today, but you can keep the conversation going online. Let us know what you thought of the episode or ask us your questions about history. You'll find us at backstoryradio.org or send an email to backstory@virginia.edu. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Backstory Radio. Whatever you do, don't be a stranger.
Special thanks this week to the Johns Hopkins Studios in Baltimore. Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the Johns Hopkins University, and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.